De la revolución del mundo.
Justice by any means
necessary. This program is brought to you by Haymarket Books as part of the Socialism 2024 program. You can hear more recordings from the conference by subscribing to the Socialism Conference podcast feed. Many video recordings are also available at socialismconference.org. If you enjoy these recordings, you should join us at Socialism 2025, which will be held in Chicago next summer, July 3rd through the 6th, 2025. If you are ready to put ideas into action and get organized with others from across the country and the world, make a plan with your organization and your friends to come to the Socialism Conference.
I want y'all to know this is a family affair. My name is AG, and I'm a part of a beautiful organization called Dream Defenders. In all spaces, we try and bring our community in. We try and bring food, dancing, conversation. And so today, we're going to be in that spirit. We can't have the food. The conference is very strict about that. But we can have the music, we can have the dancing, and most importantly, we can have the conversation. And so there will be a little bit of panel-y kind of stuff, but there's really going to be a lot of open space for us to talk to each other. The folks who are here in this space today care deeply about the topic of Black and Palestinian solidarity. It has certainly defined my organizing and truly been a place of some of my greatest political awakenings. And we know in all things there's struggle. When we talk about solidarity so much, we talk about kind of the woo-woo. Oh, you know, we came, we hugged each other. But in my experience, and I got a comrade on the stage, comrades with everybody, but like, Lemon and I be arguing. arguing down, just like, this don't make sense to me. Help me understand. So we're going to get into some of that, but I want to start in the words of the late, great Sister June Jordan, who gives this panel its title. Moving Towards Home by June Jordan. I do not wish to speak about the bulldozer and the red dirt, not quite covering all of the arms and legs. Nor do I wish to speak about the night-long screams that reached the observation post where soldiers lounged about. Nor do I wish to speak about the woman who shoved her baby into the stranger's hands before she was led away. Nor do I wish to speak about the father whose sons were shot through the head while they slit his own throat before the eyes of his wife. Nor do I wish to speak about the army that lit continuous flares into the darkness so that the others could see the backs of their victims lined against the wall. Nor do I wish to speak about the piled up bodies and the stench that will not float. Nor do I wish to speak about the nurse again and again raped before they murdered her on the hospital floor. Nor do I wish to speak about the rattling bullets that did not halt on the keening trajectory. Nor do I wish to speak about the pounding on the doors and the breaking of the windows and the hauling of families into the world of the dead. I do not wish to speak about the bulldozer in the red dirt, not quite covering all the arms and legs, because I do not wish to speak about unspeakable events that must follow from those who dare to purify a people, those who dare to exterminate a people, those who dare to describe human beings as beasts with two legs, those who dare to mop up, to tighten the noose, to step up the military pressure, to ring around civilians in the streets with tanks, those who dare to close the universities, to abolish the press, to kill the elected representatives of the people who refuse to be purified. Those are the ones from whom we must redeem the words of our beginning. Because I need to speak about home. I need to speak about a living room where the land is not bullied and beaten to a tombstone. I need to speak about the living room where the talk will take place in my language. I need to speak about the living room where my children will grow without horror. I need to speak about the living room where the men of my family between the ages and 65 are not marched into a roundup that leads to the grave. I need to talk about the living room, where I can sit without grief, without wailing aloud for my loved ones, where I must not ask where Abu Fadi is, because he will be there beside me. I need to talk about the living room, because I need to talk about home. I was born a black woman, and now I become a Palestinian. Against the relentless laughter of evil, there is less and less living room, and where are my loved ones? It is time to make our way home. I believe that poem was written by June Jordan in 1982. And there is nothing about the conditions of that poem that has changed in 2024. Those same words can be said today. We can replace a few, the flares with phosphorus, the bulldozers with bombs, even though we know that all are on the table. How many of you are familiar with June Jordan? We open with this as a testament to Black and Palestinian solidarity. But I want to be clear here that there is a complicated history and a current present in which we see unfolding in our eyes that we are struggling through and moving towards home. As was said at the plenary last night, there used to be a lot of Black Zionists. And Zionism itself was influenced by the Pan-Africanist movement. Zionists tried to make connections to Marcus Garvey, and Marcus Garvey rejected them. And the Zionist movement decided then that it would be anti-Black and make inroads in more liberal circles. There are people whose politics have changed over time, like Dr. King, who was once very affirmative of the Zionist project but saw the relentless warfare and began to change over his lifetime. And then there are fearless leaders on both sides, from Arafat to Malcolm X, who worked diligently to make connections, not just with Black people on this continent, but with Black people on the continent of Africa, making connections with the South African community. We see living, breathing embodiments of that legacy today on this stage. And we're gonna get into how we got into this moment, what has helped, in my opinion, define this moment. But before we do that, I want to actually have our esteemed panel introduce themselves. So we're going to go down, starting with Clarissa Brooks. Just tell a little bit about themselves before we get into the conversation. Thank you so much.
Good morning, y'all. I'm Clarissa Brooks. I'm a journalist and in the Tony Cade Bambara sense, a cultural worker. I'm based in Philly, but I'm from Charlotte, North Carolina, and feel very lucky to, have been building spaces with Black and Palestinian folks, doing solidarity work for a bit of time, and most recently helping Dream Defenders, along with my friends, to do Dear Gaza, which is an event we'll be having on Sunday. So hopefully we'll see y'all there.
Hello, everybody. My name is Lema. I use she, her pronouns. I'm Palestinian. I was born and raised in Saudi Arabia. I have unfortunately never been to Palestine. My parents had to seek refuge and became Jordanian citizens. But I know that one day I will be going back home to a free Palestine. I currently am based out of St. Petersburg on Tocobaga land and am part of the Tampa Bay area Dream Defenders over there and have been organizing with them for a few years and have been really loving the building that we've been doing as building Black and Palestinian power.
Good morning, everyone. My name is Linda Sarsour. I am a Palestinian-American organizer and activist born and raised in New York City. Many of you actually know me from my work mostly on Black liberation. I'm actually one of the Palestinians that Palestine was never my number one issue, and I had this firm belief that Black liberation led to the liberation of all people, including Palestinians. And one of my most memorable experiences of my organizing career was sleeping at the state capitol in Tallahassee with the young Dream Defenders, the new Dream Defenders at the time. And I was one of those, like, at that time I was still relatively young, but I was still older, much older than many of the Dream Defenders at that time. And just watching that beautiful solidarity, that consistency, that moral high ground. And even at that time in 2013, walking into the Capitol building and getting locked in, because if you left, you couldn't come back. And just watching young people wearing keffiyehs, and there was a sense of Palestine. And for the first time in a long time in the movement, I felt so seen. And I was seen not by some academic intellectuals, by young black people who were fighting for the right to live and the right to dignity and sanctity of life after the horrific murder of Trayvon Martin. So thank you to the Dream Defenders for giving me one of the most beautiful moments of my organizing career.
Hi, everybody. My name is AG. For those who will probably call me AJ at some point, my name is Ashley Green, but there's a Twilight actress that has that name, so I go by AG. And I am a Dream Defender. I'm actually been a Dream Defender member since 2014, but am currently serving in the organization as the Training and Membership Development Director. And I really appreciate you starting off by talking about the Capitol. Dream Defenders was formed out of a moment of grief and anger following the murder of Trayvon Martin. And a group of students marched from Daytona Beach to Sanford, Florida, demanding the arrest of George Zimmerman. And on that march from Daytona to Sanford, there was one flag that was present, and that was the Palestinian flag. And so from the very inception of the organization, we've been having conversations around Palestine, and our view of internationalism has broadened so much. We actually got to socialism through a delegation with the MST in Brazil, and being able to see black and brown socialists working towards taking over and cultivating the land. But I think we've gotten our definition of solidarity from our relationship to Palestinians. Definitely what has been formative to me is the experience of being in Palestine. I'm very grateful that I was able to be a part of it. And witnessing how they weren't single issue about anything. I remember meeting with an LGBT civil society organization who was like, yeah, we trying to make the society more open for us. But we need to be free in order to do that. And so we're socialists, and we are working towards a future that we can see ourselves within. But in order to get there, we first must be liberated. And so I can share a lot of different anecdotes around that, but I want to start there. Black and Palestinian solidarity has a rich history, from delegations and exchanges going from the U.S. to Palestine and vice versa. And it's also been central, I think, to this generation's movement building. So much of what has sprung up began in 2012, began in 2013, but really came to life in 2014 when we saw the violence and ethnic cleansing happening in Gaza and the uprising happening in Ferguson and the very real connection that was made in that moment. And so I want to talk to you about what was your foundational moment of solidarity, and how does it shape how you show up in the work? We can start with Clarissa.
Yeah, I was just having like a visceral flashback. So in journalism, I actually wanted to be a war reporter. And so I remember specifically watching, I think his name's Dan Golden, but he was doing reporting about Gaza. And I remember just following what was happening on the Gaza Strip. And it was also my first year of college. And understanding, one, I definitely don't want to do war reporting. Also just like the politics of being a war reporter and being a black woman is complicated. So that wasn't reasonable for me, but it did give me the space to join movement and to learn more about like internationalism and solidarity. And so thankfully within that year, I was able to join organization and was able to learn about Palestine and get more clarity on it. Cause I think for me, I didn't have that. And I was given a lot of space to learn and be wrong with my friends and my comrades. And from there, I was also given a lot of space to also just be in reading groups. I think that's something I miss as I get deeper in movement, is to just like read a text together with people, annotate, ask questions, you know, just actually read Karl Marx and sit with people through that. So that was my first moment. And then I also, as I joined more like Black literary spaces, learned more about the importance of folks like June Jordan and her legacy of following Black and brown and Arab women who kind of got her on the right path to understanding what internationalism is.
Yeah, I'd say for me, it's definitely been a journey, just like everything that we do in this world, right? We're constantly growing and learning. So for me, the first times that I kind of started seeing these connections was when I moved to the States and I started seeing how Black people were treated. And I couldn't help but see the similarities. And I'm not gonna lie, growing up, I had a lot of anti-Blackness. And that's the reality for a lot of us, right? We have a lot of bias and it has been a struggle for me, and I can only have done it with my comrades, my Black comrades, my white comrades, my Latin comrades, every single one who has held me accountable. And through the years, like I continued to see more and more and then started making the connections into, you know, the atrocities that were happening with Black people here, mimicking the atrocities that are happening with Palestine. But then I grew to learn more and more what it actually means to stand with a people, and that I don't necessarily need to see those connections to stand against oppression. The oppression that we see against Black people, yes, there's a lot of similarities and there's also differences between what's happening with Palestinians, but it was the understanding, it wasn't until like I really understood capitalism and the atrocities of capitalism that I, like, it clicked in my head what it meant to fight against the atrocities that capitalism inflicts and how capitalism intentionally uses things like racism to divide and conquer. So for me, that's kind of been my journey in the solidarity and understanding what it means to fight for Black liberation and how inextricable it is linked to the fight for Palestinian liberation, because we all deserve to be free of oppression. We all deserve to have socialism and be free of capitalism. So that's the thing that kind of like helped ground me in really understanding our shared struggle.
I think for me, solidarity started at a much younger age, and maybe I just didn't have the words to describe what it was. My father is a very stereotypical Palestinian guy who owned a bodega in Crown Heights, Brooklyn.
Love that.
Right on the corner of Troy and Montgomery. And I remember after school, my mom would sometimes need to go help my dad at the store, so that would require that we all went to the store. And my dad had this little living room that he set up in the back, which was you go do your homework and then you go play outside. And outside was Crown Heights, and Crown Heights at the time in the 80s, late 80s, early 90s, was a predominantly Black, Caribbean, Puerto Rican community. And so I was from Sunset Park. Sunset Park was predominantly Latino, Puerto Rican, Dominican, Asian. So that's the community that I grew up in, or where my house that I lived in was. And then after school, I had this other group of friends that were from Crown Heights. And so I grew up playing with Black children. I grew up with a father who ran a business for 40 years in a Black, predominantly Black community. And then over time, also a very large Orthodox Jewish community that came into the neighborhood. I also went to John Jay High School. John Jay High School is in Park Slope, Brooklyn. It's changed over the years, but when I went there, they used to call it Jungle Jay because it was apparently, according to everybody else, it was a quote, bad school. It wasn't a bad school. It was just a school with a lot of Black children in it that were basically brought in, bused from, you know, other parts of New York City, or mostly other parts of Brooklyn. And I had a wonderful time in high school, because in my school, I was the very tiny little minority. There were like six Palestinian kids in my 4,000 people school. And so the Palestinian kids had to decide where they were going to align. And the most natural place for us to align was with the black students in our school. So you would see all the black students, then you would see the six Palestinians, and I was one of them. And so for naturally for me, those times, and I watched, and I wrote about this in my book, I watched so much go on in my school. I watched policing and the arrest of children in schools before NYPD was a thing inside of public schools. My schools had bars on them. We had metal detectors before a lot of schools in New York City had metal detectors. So there was always something in me that was like, something's wrong here. Like, this is not okay. And then as time goes by, you grow up, you know, you go to university, you kind of go out into the community. And then I started organizing after the horrific attacks of 9/11, and just finding myself in just so many places of solidarity, and understanding the struggles of policing in the New York City from racial and religious profiling and how those things were interconnected, how we were criminalized just based on our identities. And I remember a sign that my daughter carried in a protest. And she was probably like, I don't know, maybe 8 years old at the time. And it said, praying while Muslim and walking while black, which of course you could do both of those things, just to be clear. But the sign said, praying while Muslim and walking while black are not a crime. And that moment of seeing us build a police reform movement in New York City around the intersections of the targeting of Muslim American communities, who of course also include black people, and also the targeting of black youth in New York, was incredible. And the one first moment watching our community organize was around Floyd versus the City of New York, which was a lawsuit launched against the New York Police Department by young black and brown youth who sued the New York Police Department all over the stop and frisk unconstitutional practice. And they were these young people that went up against the biggest police force in the country. And in fact, the judge, as you all know, ruled in favor of those young people, that the NYPD was in fact engaging in unconstitutional discriminatory practice. But one day, what we were doing in the movement is each day there was a community that was anchoring the court date, because the court was open to the public, so you could pack the courthouse. And it was a decently sized courtroom, maybe the size of this. And this one beautiful day, it was our turn. It was my people's turn. And just watching a beautiful sea of young women and people from our community in hijabis, just a beautiful sea, to the point where the judge like kind of got caught off guard, like, whoa, I never seen nothing like this before. And those were like the most beautiful moments on power. And when those young people were sitting in those courtroom, young black and brown men between ages maybe 18 to 24, and just being able to see every day a new group of people that was like, we are with you, we are with you, we are in this together. It was just the things that uplifted my spirit. But I will say, to Lema's point, I don't want to be utopian here. You know, we come from communities where there is absolutely anti-blackness, as that is not exclusive to any community, particularly for immigrant communities who come from other parts of the world. You come to a country like the United States of America where race is a construct, and people learn very quickly how the hierarchy is. And so immigrant communities, as a form of protection, start trying to align with the lightest of the skin, right, with where they believe power is. And so that is not something that I'm all proud of from the communities I come from. But as Lema said, it's a lot of work we have done over the years to deconstruct anti-blackness in our community, to figure out the origins of where it comes from, because it doesn't come from where our people are from. In Palestine, that's not a thing. But we learned that here coming to this country in the way that this country set up. So just want you to know we're still on that journey, that we are not a perfect community. And it's something that we work through. And, you know, we don't ask you for grace, but know that we are and have incredible organizers across this country who continue to do that work so that we could be better, because we can all be better.
I mean, that's a perfect segue, and I'll talk a little bit about how I got here, and then we're just going to dig into that more deeply. You know, the 2010s were a magical time on the internet. I don't know if y'all remember a little thing called Tumblr. I was in these Tumblr streets. I was. I was a media studies major in college. I was a little bit disillusioned with the landscape, and had started organizing in earnest. But I was really fascinated with the Arab Spring. and how Twitter and Facebook and these social media platforms became a space of organizing towards a revolutionary action. And I know that there's a lot of commentary that has come out post, and I think there are some panels here about it. And so I want to encourage y'all to dig into that. But I was so fascinated by what was going on in the Arab Spring, and that really sort of shifted my politics around Palestine. In college, the 2008 incursion happened on the Gaza Strip, but there weren't Palestinians on my campus. The only people that were talking about it were Hillel. And, you know, I was a little multicultural affairs student, and so I got one perspective. And the internet just didn't have, like, ways that you could go and, like, search a thing and find it like today. You didn't have, like, a TikTok to, like, help educate you. And so I was just like, oh, okay, this seems messed up, but I'm going to, like, I see you in person. I'm going to kind of trust what you say. By the time 2014 had hit, the Arab Spring had really, like, deconstructed me. Like, I got that this was imperialism. And I was posting about what was happening in Gaza on my Tumblr. And I was following the different tweets and all the tragedy, all of the infuriating activity that was happening. And then things kind of quieted down for a little bit. And then August 3rd happened, or is it August 8th? August 8th, where Mike Brown was murdered. It was sometime between the 3rd and the 8th. We just came up on the 10th anniversary. And I remember being on Twitter, and somehow there was just something different instantly on Twitter about the ways in which folks in St. Louis were doing citizen journalism, were just posting it, and it started to feel a little bit like the Arab Spring. Like, we were just getting updates in real time about what was happening. I knew I was getting photos, I was getting footage, and I was trying to, again, post them on my Tumblr. And throughout the days that followed, as the police, the military force in Ferguson and St. Louis escalated, I started to notice that Palestinians, particularly in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip, were posting the tear gas canisters. And they were like, hey, the thing that you just threw back at the cops was the same thing that we have right here. Here's how you treat it. Here's how you take care of it. That's where I learned about milk of magnesia to, like, clear out my face from tear gas. And in real time, people were, like, talking about how to make gas masks. How to, like, take, you know, the soda bottle container, and how to make shields and how to protect yourself. And instantly, I could tell that they weren't, like, doing it to get, like, get points. They weren't like, hey, talk about what's happening in Gaza. This is happening here, too. They were just literally like, please protect yourself. You matter, we matter. At the same time, the students had gone missing in Mexico, and I saw people posting about from Mexico to Palestine to America, all these military forces have to go. And it really helped me see the generosity of solidarity. Sometimes the selflessness of solidarity. And over the years, I've started to understand the self-interest. And I think the mutuality and reciprocity that come with solidarity, but in that moment, I saw genuinely the generosity of people who just wanted to keep each other safe. And it deeply informed how I moved in all of those moments following, and it literally gave me skills and tactics that I then went and taught to other people as we were getting tear gas shot to us in Florida. Yeah, I'm a recovering Floridian. It's a struggle, but we're here. But yeah, you know, as we protested in the street and faced the same kind of violence as we went to St. Louis in solidarity, as we went to LA in solidarity, as we went all across the country, these became the skills that helped shape how we kept each other safe. Absolutely.
I, of course, remembered something after everybody went. But for context on my organizing, I went to Spelman College, which is an HBCU in Atlanta, Georgia. And so I was a part of a student organization called AUC Shut It Down. And one was on Twitter at the same time as that. And I think my kind of biggest second entry point was learning about the GILLI program. Have folks heard about the mm-hmm. GILLI program? So Georgia State University has a police and training exchange with Israel. So all of the ways that police are trained in Atlanta, they literally fly and pay for Israeli officers to come to America to train police officers in Georgia. And also they send Atlanta PD to Israel to learn how they harass and kill Palestinians. And so learning about that program as a student really gave me such a clear analysis on what the Imperial Court is, how it functions, and how cops fund and move money to train and kill Black folks, and how it was directly impacting myself as a student, but also like the West End of Atlanta, how the city of Atlanta builds this like idea of a Black Mecca, but has so much money invested in criminalization and cops. You know, GILLI is also kind of the baby step of Cop City. I was also really lucky to be one of the students that was there in 2017 when the Cop City organizing kind of started. And that was my biggest entry point. And then also learning very specifically that Zionists have a huge interest in HBCUs. A lot of Zionist programs actually have birthright chips that they send Black student presidents on. So they'll pay for like students who are like presidents at schools, kids, to go to Israel and do birthright trips. Same with like the FBI, they do like job forums at HBCUs as well. And seeing that and making those connections, and also being somebody who grew up in North Carolina, growing up low income and having such a visceral understanding of how the police impacted my family and my communities, it kind of felt seamless for me to understand that solidarity wasn't just charity or about feeling good, but also about like our connected struggles are connected through policing and jails, and understanding that the money that's killing my family and my cousins is also killing Puerto Ricans, is also killing Palestinians, mm-hmm. is also killing Haitian folks. And that felt so clear to me as soon as I was able to learn and organize with folks around GILLI.
Thank you so much for that. And I think that really just speaks to some of the connections that have helped sort of strengthen this relationship of solidarity as we fight against displacement, be it on in Jenin or in the Bronx, as we see people forcibly removed from their homes through military intervention in the form of our police state or in the form of the Israeli occupation force. And as we really sort of see the impact of segregation in our communities here and in Jerusalem, in the quarter. And so I want to hone in on that a little bit, but I also kind of want to get into some of the stickier stuff as we sort of wrap up this portion before we get into the Q&A. We've talked about it here, and then I'm guessing most of y'all have seen it online. But social media has been such a rich place for connection and education. I think reciprocally, we've had opportunities to learn from each other, learn with each other. And we see right now how social media is being used to divide us, and very intentionally used to divide us. We have bans of social media apps that have been introduced in order to break down this relationship of solidarity. And we have speakers from the Israeli occupation forces who have said that Black and Palestinian solidarity, AIPAC has said that Black and Palestinian solidarity is a real problem for us being able to defend the Zionist project. These are statements on record. And so we see right now how there's a narrative of conflict and tension that has emerged from a space that has been genuinely rooted in connecting and amplifying how our struggles are shared. And so I want to get in a little bit into where you think that's coming from, and what do we do to combat it? What do you think actually helps keep us intertwined and connected as we try and move towards a liberated world? I had a lot of words, and I was like, let me try and cut them down.
So I'm going to start And I'm going to take you back to take you forward for us to understand this particular moment. And I could take you all the way back to COINTELPRO, but I won't take you all the way back to the original version. I'm going to take you to a newer version that a lot of people kind of went over their head. Many of you know I'm one of the co-founders of the Women's March on Washington, and that was the largest anti-Trump movement in the country at the time. And as you know, organized the largest single day demonstration in American history up until today. And one of the things that went over people's head is that I was Palestinian, and I was one of the co-chairs of the Women's March on Washington. It was the largest resistance group at that time. And the other co-chair was Tamika D. Mallory, who's a black woman who's many people know. She comes out of like the Reverend Jesse Jackson, kind of Al Sharpton type, organizing, very church, you know, just doing the kind of Rainbow Coalition type organizing. Tamika went to Palestine. And Tamika and I were friends for, we've been friends for almost 15 years now, really close, and Tamika has learned a lot about Palestine over time. And we were the most two visible forces in the Women's March on Washington. And as many of you know, the Women's March did the Women's March and just went downhill from there. The amount of external forces that attacked the Women's March that included even an operation within our larger movement, right? Really helped to undermine the Women's March at the time, although some of its most visible leaders were intersectional organizers and have been outside and risking their lives for way before there was ever a Women's March. And what happened was, is the Russian government, which this is gonna, we're coming up actually on the second anniversary of a front page article that was about me in the New York Times, and it was an investigation where the Russian government, the intelligence division of the military, of the Russian government out of St. Petersburg, Russia, ran an operation online, basically targeting the Women's March and trying to break down and basically created a lot of divisions and inside our own movements, not just the people, I'm not talking about right-wing Zionists and others that were already attacking Women's March, because that was already online, but they ran an operation after the election of Donald Trump for the entire year of 2017 into 2018. Specifically to undermine Women's March, because they basically looked around and said, who's the most visible force against Trump? Who's our friend? Oh, those ladies, we're gonna take them down. And they specifically chose me as an individual, as a way, as a proxy to the Women's March, because I was the easiest target. I was Palestinian, right? An issue that is bipartisan in this country. You are anti-Palestinian, doesn't matter what political spectrum you're on, you can find people who are. I'm also Muslim, I wear hijab, so God forbid there was a woman in hijab that's Muslim that's part of anything relatively close to feminism, right? Somehow I was an infiltrator, I was a theocrat, I was a front for some conservative movement in this country that was trying to infiltrate progressive spaces. I mean, they had it all, they figured it all out, had a whole narrative going. My point is that the bottom line is it did impact Women's March, and there is still a Women's March that is around, but it's not the Women's March, right? It wasn't the Women's March that we were pushing. As you all know, when we put out the feminist agenda back in 2019, we included boycott, divestment, sanctions. We included platform against the war, the Saudi-led war in Yemen at that time, because we were teaching women across this country, including white women, that all of these issues intersect. Incarceration, right? Immigration and immigrant rights, that it was not just about equal pay and reproductive rights. And those kinds of conversations were a threat to the status quo and a threat to the conservative right in this country, and also to liberals and neoliberals in our movements that saw the Women's March as what they probably originally thought was going to be with them. And we were like, yeah, nah. Yeah, maybe that January 21st you wore your pink pussy hat and it was cute, but that's not what this is about. And so just wanted to take you there to bring you here. Right now, there's a conversation, for those that have not seen this conversation, of kind of debates, and sometimes a little bit more worse than debates, between black and Palestinians on the internet. And I'm not saying, as my mom would say, there's no smoke without fire. And I'm not saying that there aren't videos that were up. There was this one video of this young brother from Detroit, who's a young Palestinian kid, who said some things that if I saw him, I'd be like, listen, bro, are you serious right now? Like, he called Kamala the B word. Like, I don't care what you think of Kamala. Like, you don't call her the B word, right? There is a way to critique Kamala for her policies, for who and what she's done, but not because of her race, not because of her gender, and not to be a damn misogynist. Like, that's just not acceptable to me. I don't care. I'll say that to anybody in the movement. But I will say that, so there's these debates now happening about this election. Oh, are Palestinians being self-righteous and selfish that we're about to give this election to Donald Trump? It's because we don't care about black people. We don't care about, you know, other marginalized people, that, you know, we don't care about our own people. And so I think, just to give people a little perspective, I've been doing a lot of conversations and analyzation about this. The first thing that I'll say is there got to be grace in our movements, friends. We have to have grace in our movements. These young Palestinians are watching the literal evisceration of their communities, of their people, of those that they love. They're watching blown up limbs and blown up communities. They are sitting at home watching videos that you watch while you look and say, wow, this is horrific. We are looking for people that we recognize in those videos. Those could be our uncles and aunties and cousins at any moment in those videos. So people are speaking from a place of horror because they're responding to something. And I'm stuck. I'm in a stuck place. I don't know if people ever get into those stuckness place in the movement. One part of me understands, generally speaking, that we are in this interesting moment of, like, we're watching this black woman rise in the echelons of one of the main parties of this country in our lifetime. And so we're watching a black woman, and we're watching the power and sometimes the not power of representation. And so we do also understand that it's not about Kamala. It's about 4 decades of black women organizing in this country, right? For power, for leadership. And we know that when black women, not all black women, not all Palestinians, not all anybody, but our movement leaders, when black women are in power, we know that that power is going to be manifested into justice for all of us. And so this organizing work that people see right now and saw the response to Kamala Harris, we started seeing people that were saying what's happening in Gaza is horrific, but all of a sudden are now celebrating Kamala Harris. And so there's a visceral reaction to that, because Kamala Harris is not just the United States senator from a state. She's the current sitting vice president of the United States of America. So if she was just a member of Congress or someone that was far removed, or maybe a vice president from 2 administrations ago, I think people would have kind of went along a little bit. But you're talking to young Palestinians on the internet about a woman who is a sitting vice president of the United States of America, the current administration that is aiding and abetting a whole genocide, and has relatively been silent about this genocide. And so again, that's where this is coming from. It's the reaction to Joe Biden stepping down, movement seeing that as a win, because it was, because they knew damn sure well Joe Biden was a political liability for the party. And they said, sit yourself down over here, relax for a second. They, of course, were not going to give us credit for that. They wanted us to be stupid enough to believe that one little debate for an hour and a half was the reason you made Joe Biden sit down. No, it was all of us. We made Joe Biden sit down. And then there was organizing that happened, because there were some people that didn't want Kamala to be the nominee. You know that. Whether or not we are aligned with Kamala doesn't matter. Anti-black racism is against every black person. They don't care what kind. They're capitalists, neoliberals, poor working class, organized. They don't care. So again, there's this weird stuckness that I'm in, that I understand the monumentalness of this moment for many black women and many black communities, not everybody, right? But I also see the other side of it, which are people being like, whoa, I feel betrayed. I feel hurt. I feel harmed in this moment. And so that's a real conversation. I just wanted to start by saying this ain't all the psyops, because people are saying that. There's actually real courageous conversation, real tension that we have to work through for the movement. I'm not going to blame it all on the Russians, and I'm not going to blame it all on COINTELPRO. I'm just saying the reason why I bring up the Russians, and I'm not saying that the Russians are involved this time around. I'm saying that, yes, when outside forces see tension, they see smoke rising, they capitalize and they leverage that in the moment. So I'm just saying that it's real, but it gets exaggerated by those who, as AG said, benefit from breaking and fracturing black Palestinian solidarity. I promise you, my friends, and I will say this till the day that I die, that our liberation, everybody's, but in particular, black and Palestinian liberation, is bound up with one another. I promise you, either way it goes, if the Palestinians are freed first, black people are going to be free. If black people are fully free in the United States of America, Palestinians will be free. Intrinsic. And I promise you that the forces of evil have determined that. And they will work to any lengths to destroy that. And that is what we are not going to allow them to happen. So let's struggle through the conversation. Let's call in our comrades when they speak out of line, because we do that, because we are flawed human beings. We speak from places of hurt, and we've all done that in our personal lives, where you say something to someone that you love, and then a few hours later, you're like, damn, I didn't mean to say it like that. I didn't mean to engage in this conversation in that way, although I still have those feelings. And so I just want to bring this to the space that even in our movements, we are human beings. We are going to say things that hurt others, because hurt people hurt people. And so we got to be able to move through that. But right now, what I'm not going to do is I'm not going to allow anybody to divide us in one of the most prominent moments of Black Palestinian solidarity, and one of the moments that we have been the closest to liberation than we have ever been before. And I am not going to forfeit my friends, my colleagues, my movement relationships, and all the work that our ancestors did because somebody saw a little crack and stuck themselves right in there.
I can tell you had a word on your heart. You have been thinking about that for a minute. And I don't want to lose track of this thread because I think we probably all have real reflections. I'm not going to lie. I am definitely a person that's been, this is a psyop. I'm like these accounts came out of nowhere. These are not people that have been talking about Black and Palestinian solidarity or Palestine. And, you know, I think that they are exacerbating real tensions. I think we do have that adage of trust Black women that comes into conflict with, yeah, but she's running to be the head of the snake, and I don't have to trust that. And we have, ways in which we have stopped talking to each other and are talking past each other. The timing is what's so curious. The timing is what I struggle with. And I don't want us to lose this thread, but I want to make sure we have space to bring you all into the conversation. I just want to hear from Clarissa and Lima about what do you think keeps us united in this moment of maybe very real and human tension, but also very real and manufactured tension.
Yeah, I'll share really quick. Not committing to really quick. So it's been interesting. It has led to a lot of interesting conversations, but what I want to say is those conversations need to be happening offline.
Mm. That's right.
Get off these phones. Get off social media. Go touch some grass. Go to the streets. That's where we need to be having these conversations because, as we said, like, tensions have always existed. We all come from different places. We are not going to be the like epitome of an incredible organizer or activist or person or human being or whatever overnight. It takes struggle, and these conversations need to be happening in person. I know, especially with COVID and pandemic, and things have shifted, and we lost a little bit of that. But we have to find ways to still connect with each other because we do have a decades-long history of solidarity. We cannot forget that. We have, whether it was, Malcolm X going to Gaza, so just like think of these moments historically. Whether we even have Yahya Sinwar, who was talking about, and I quote, "I want to take this opportunity to remember the racist murder of George Floyd. George Floyd was killed as a result of a racist ideology held by some people. The same type of racism that killed Floyd is being used by Israel against the Palestinians." We know what the reality is. We know this. And so this is something that we always have to come back to and center. And we cannot let people like the establishment using people like Kamala or like Obama as these Black people to distract us of what our true liberation is, because the reality is we have a shared enemy and we always have to come back to that. So whenever in doubt, take a step back. Think to yourself, am I feeding into imperialism? Am I feeding into capitalism? And then ask the other person that question. Right? Don't go on the defensive. We need to be constantly building these relationships and having these hard conversations. And don't shy away from them, as challenging as they are. AJ mentioned earlier, we've had challenging conversations, and I will say for myself, I am a better person for it today. Mm-hmm. And I'm constantly being called in by the people that I love and I care about, and I am so grateful for that. So I think that's just something that's important. And then one thing that I do also want to highlight is like this idea of tarakum, which in Arabic means accumulation. This is like something that we constantly take into our resistance because it is a building, it's an accumulation of all the lessons that we have learned. So don't, like I say how important it is to not let things like this prevent us from being able to move forward, because this is not the first time. It's gonna happen again, mm-hmm. but let's take on these lessons. Let's remember that before we react. Because that's how they expect us. That's how they respond. They're very reactionary. We can't come from that same place. We have to come from a place of understanding and a place from realizing who the real enemy is. So. Oh, I'm so sorry. One more thing. Okay. How many people here are on like multiple group chats? Yeah, I can't even count the number of group chats. That's also another place where organizing does not happen. Right? So, just like I said, get off social media, get in the streets. Just in the group chat, find a time to meet. Okay, that's it. That's what the purpose
don't
is.
Don't have an argument in the signal.
That's what the purpose is. Go talk to people. Okay, that's all I had to add. You're fine.
I actually wanted to maybe expand a little bit more on the whole, like, go touch grass thing. I feel like people say it a lot. But there's actually a lot of, like, writing and discourse about just how social media sites are set up to build conflict and to pull mm-hmm. context out of conversation. Like, folks aren't saying it to be like, you know, just get off your phone. It really is like Twitter, TikTok, the mechanisms of how you respond to people, quote tweeting, it's set up for you to see something out of context, argue with it, and build an idea about what somebody's saying, and build division. So it's not just like a phrase, it really is, these apps are set up to, yeah, build discourse. Like they make money off of building discourse. And that discourse, that ad revenue going to Elon, even that white man who owned it before, as much as we use it for our own organizing, it inherently is used to, yeah, stir tension. Like we've all been in that place where you're like, why is my heart rate up? Why is my shoulders up? Why am I pissed and I've been on Twitter for 1 minute, right? Like that's, it runs on our rage, it runs on our confusion and our upset. So it truly is not just a phrase, it really is like a mechanism for us to understand that we wanna be in context with our people, we wanna be having conversations where people can see us fully and also understand that someone isn't seeing us fully, but you can't really see that through an exchange online. So personally, as you know, a hothead who used to be on Twitter cussing everybody out, and I really loved it. Like I really enjoyed it. Like it really gave me like, out. Right? Like it really gave me a dopamine hit to cuss out politicians, to cuss out local people, especially in Atlanta. Like I was on Keisha Lance Bottom every week, but in person, when I actually was organizing around policing, I was like, oh, this person, one, actually does not know what she's doing, and two, doesn't even understand the mechanism and the monster that she's inside of. And that made it much more easier to organize against her. And thankfully, we were able to unseat her in Atlanta. But I wanted to add a little bit to this idea of unity. I think also, one, I'm personally not impressed by black politicians ever, and I think the privilege of that is being in the South, having black politicians who espouse these ideas of unity and uplift and social mobility, and I never see that happening in my community. Mm-hmm. My folks have been voting for black politicians all their lives, and we're still living in the same neighborhoods. And so that is one. I also think inherently, like, I feel like looking back at history, black folks have always been told we need to vote for our safety and for our survival, and we're still in the same conditions. And so I think for me personally, when I hear black folks being like, you know, we can't focus on Palestine right now, I'm like, we've been told that since the war on drugs. Mm-hmm. We've been told that since mm-hmm. Jim Crow. right? That we need to vote for our safety, that we just need to look at our stuff and focus on us. And it's still the same. Yeah. So if in this moment, if there's a larger system that we're all tied and connected to, what if we actually work together to do that kind of work? And I think lastly, I wanted to mention, because I brought it up earlier, June Jordan has this essay that she wrote in Essence Magazine in June 1983. It's called Black Folks in Foreign Policy. I think if you're a Black organizer, you should read it. It's really important. Also, Essence Magazine is not radical in any way, so, right? Like, her getting that there is a very big deal. And I think that is a good entry point to understand, one, imperialism, internationalism, because she literally runs through Palestine, Cuba, Nicaragua, like all of these times in history that Black folks have again been requested to vote for the Democratic ticket and be happy about it. And I think we have a really beautiful chance this time to say, no, I don't want to do that. Or no, I want to do something different. I know for myself, I know a lot of folks are like, I just care about down ballot. I want to talk about what's happening locally for me. What are my city council members doing? What are my school like board members doing? And letting y'all have the rest. But yeah, that's how I'm pushing forward and really thinking about. Also, I think lastly, in Black communities, I'm not as impressed by anti-Blackness from non-Black people when I'm hearing anti-Blackness from Black people. Mm. Especially like, when I saw those like arguments online, I was kind of like, okay, I'm not surprised. If you're not Black, that makes sense that you would want to be in a system of power. But I struggle the most sitting with my own inherently taught anti-Blackness and sitting with other Black people about how we've been taught anti-Blackness and around class and around privilege and colorism. So yeah, for me, I was like, this is cute, but you know, I'm trying to focus on what me and my people need to do, you know, and how we need to be in solidarity with folks.
Thank you for that. And yes. I think there are a couple of things that y'all said that just are sitting present on my mind. One, Kamala Harris and Barack Obama and sort of the anointed Black faces of imperial power are not ignorant. They're not oblivious. Edward Said was one of Barack Obama's teachers. Barack Obama knows what's happening in Palestine. Kamala Harris's father is one of the most renowned Jamaican communist scholars. And so it is not as if these people are unaware and need to be educated around what's happening. They have made a choice to represent empire. And we have to make sure that we don't fall into the feel-good politics of validating their choices by celebrating. Now, I do electoral organizing. I think there are a lot of different choices and calculations that people put into motion. And I see elections as a place in which we help define our political terrain and what is possible within a segment of time in the system that we are in as we are trying to build an alternative. And so I am not here to make a prescription on how you move in this moment. But I do think that what will support people in moving in this moment is being in a political organization, being in a political home that has concrete values through which you can hold yourself and your comrades accountable to. Otherwise, it's a lot of noise and people arguing about what they got on TikTok. And, you know, TikTok has definitely been a place of people's political awakening. I'm not villainizing it. Again, Tumblr was a site where I had a lot of exposure to discourse. Those things were important. But just having those messages didn't make me a revolutionary. Being in practice with comrades like Lima, being in practice with people struggling, going, struggling, failing, struggling, trying, experimenting, struggling, those are the things that help me be a revolutionary and help me be accountable to the solidarity that has been built. And so I say it is so critical for us to find a home. And you can move houses. It'd be real. This is one of the few rent-free places that you can go. You can shop around. You can find a space that fits for you, but find a place that has a politic that you are willing to put into practice, that you are willing to struggle around, that you are willing to be wrong in the service of getting free. in the service of learning how to be right. There are so many right people in the world that still aren't free. And there are so many people who think that they have the revolutionary solution, even though we have yet to have the revolution itself. And being an organization becomes a place where you can actually not just be right, but be in practice with your people around what you believe. And so that's just a thing that I think is really critical to say in terms of unity and in terms of accountability. But we have talked a lot. We've talked a lot. And I want y'all to talk a little bit. So you're going to turn to your neighbor. Turn to your neighbor. You're going to say, hey, neighbor. Hey, neighbor. What's on your heart right now? And spend a couple of minutes talking about what's coming up in this conversation, and think about what you might want to offer in the form of a question or a concise comment.
Concise comment.
Because we want to spend the rest of this in dialogue with one another.
And literally as we started, I was like, no. It's all the way in the hall too.
Yeah,
it's
not gonna
happens
work.
Every time. It's fine. I'll push this. Yeah. Everybody take a break.
I did not think about social media in the way that you were saying, like, how intentional it is.
Yeah, there's a lot of writers who've written about, like, there's a writer named Gia Tolentino who has a book about the book is called Trick Mirror. But she basically talks about how, like, you can only perform one self online. And so oftentimes you're interacting with that self, and, like, how social media kind of feeds on that lack of content. It's really good. J-I-A. J-I-A-T-O. L-E-N-T-I-N-O. And it's such a good book. Yeah. It's so good. Also, really tall.
All right, and start to bring your conversations to a period. Not a close, not an end, just a punctuation. Maybe even an ellipsis. A little dot, dot, dot. All right, this is only going to reach a few people, but those who do follow along. I go.
I may.
I go.
I may.
Say this. I go.
I may.
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 All right. All right. All right. Thank y'all so much. I can tell y'all are in spirited conversation. And if you identify as a BIPOC individual, a Black, Indigenous, or a person of color, broadly, we have a social happening tomorrow at 1 p.m. that you can go and dig deeper into some conversation. And so, again, this is an ellipsis, not an end, but a beginning of a way for us to continue to be in dialogue. But I want to welcome you all's comments and commentary. So we're going to take a couple of folks from the audience that have things that are sitting on their heart before we begin to close out. We'll go bucket cap, and then you, that's the one you got? I got you, sir. Catherine, and then Catherine. And we're going to see how many we can take. I see you, I see you, I see you, I see you. Oh, okay, this is robust. Actually, I can't promise we're going to get to everybody, but I am going to ask that you get in line. We're going to do our best to do something of a progressive stack. But go on ahead and please try and keep it short so that we can welcome in as much as possible.
Hi, can y'all hear me?
We can hear you.
Good, okay.
Yes.
My name is Maddie. I'm with the Debt Collective, and I just want to appreciate all of you are amazing. First, I have a question about the attention economy. So I'm seeing some parallels between the Me Too movement. It was a hashtag, right? Black Lives Matter was a hashtag. Free Palestine, hashtag, right? And I see the ways in which like social media grabs people's attention for these short spans of time, and it's really heightened, and then it kind of trails off a little bit. And so I was wondering, as seasoned organizers, what do you do to maintain that consistent attention for yourself and also when you're organizing with other people?
Hello. So something that's been on my heart that's both a comment and a question is, I believe it was back in like December, the Palestinian journalist, I'm gonna pronounce her wrong, but Bisan Alua, posted a photo of her having to cut her hair due to the water shortage that is inflicted on Gaza. And it made me started thinking about the symbolism that comes with being a Black woman and cutting our hair. Mm-hmm. And something I've been in struggle with trying to talk to fellow Black people is, of course we are an oppressed group, but by having a little blue passport, we have a lot of privilege. Mm-hmm. And trying to talk to Black people in this moment of a Kamala Harris and saying, hey, life sucks right now for us, but also we are American citizens, and that comes with a lot of blood on our hands as well. And so thinking about someone like Bisan who had to cut her hair, not by choice, but then I think about Black women and symbolism of liberation for us to cut our hair. I just think about like that back and forth right now. So I'd love to know any thoughts or language you all have on acknowledging the privilege Black Americans have by being American, to be in solidarity with Palestinians who are victimized by an imperialist system.
Thank you, thank you. We're gonna take one more and then we'll take some responses.
Thank y'all. I heard you say several things that spoke to me. I'm from Charlotte as well, and when you said you're not impressed by Black politicians, I took that personally, because as a Black politician, I too am not impressed by Black politicians. And smallest of background to the question, when I ran for office, it was years before October, and I understand a lot of people think that history started October of last year, but we know otherwise. And in a moment when I was being eaten up alive and they're spending millions of dollars calling me anti-Semitic, there were Palestinian folks locally and abroad and nationwide who helped get me through that race. We have a Black caucus in Colorado. Is anybody here from Colorado? We have a Black caucus in Colorado, and our one Palestinian legislator is a member of that caucus. The tension that we have had has not been similar to that has been largely discussed today. When I say we within the Black caucus and the Black community, that's because it's either in or out. They're either the Black folks who went on the Israel trips and aren't gonna sign the ceasefire statement, or they're Black folks wearing Palestinian flags in the Capitol. So that's kind of where we are. The question that I'm asking for some therapy and some help on is, I have not done a good job of knowing how to respond when Palestinians are asking different things of me. To speak up or not, to take the ceasefire statement a certain way or not. And so while no group is monolithic or homogenous, and of course different strategies are at play, it's been the first time that I've had to be asked to be less radical in a space. And when Palestinians, for example, last week, the DNC, right? My colleagues are there from Colorado. We didn't have a present vote. Everybody from Colorado voted for Kamala Harris. And so when a Palestinian legislator is asking me to not say more, I just would love any help about, and this is community, it's a parallel to community as well, how to weigh who I'm being guided by, because I feel like I don't have a vote in the intercommunity discussion, but how do I prioritize knowing which way to be of use? I hope that makes some sense. Thank you for helping me get this job, and of course, those of us who stood up for Palestine will all lose it, so, but thank you. Woo!
All right, so we have a comment and a curiosity around the attention economy and how that is impacting this moment. Some of the dichotomy of liberatory and oppressive sort of symbolism, the cutting of hair and how that has been for a lot of black folks. Hair is a site of struggle. It's a site of revolutionary action. It's in some of the small ways that we have our biggest revolutionary kind of experiences. And then sort of the forced, oppressive state of having to cut your hair because the conditions are so unlivable and unmanageable. And then the tension of like intra-community politics. Like, if a Palestinian says something, do I have to do it? If a black person says something, do I have to do it? How do I move in my principles while moving in a practice of solidarity and struggle? And so I'm gonna open up those for any responses on your heart. Quickly though, quick.
I'll do the attention economy one, because I think it's like kind of more like a comms question, which is more so like, what kind of impact do you want? Specifically like thinking about Me Too, like yes, those are hashtags, but they're also like fully developed movements and they have a legacy of organizers behind them. And so I think if you wanna play like the short game of like, hey, it's a hashtag and you can get the virality, the short impact of that can get you like short-term visibility for the work you're doing. But I think, and I, you know, am lucky to be friends with Fresco Stees, who like, y'all have seen the InfoBL defund the police mask. Like for me, I'm thinking about how do you create cultural work that lives past the moment? And so for me, virality is not that interesting. It also just runs on an algorithm. It really just runs on a computer and machine that says what consumers are clicking this and how can we connect some sort of consumer product to it. It really isn't that impressive to me. And a lot of those things, a lot of those moments, even like Me Too, were around white supremacist response to Me Too. It wasn't necessarily that the movement itself was growing, it was that white women got onto it. And that isn't the kind of impact that I want for our work. I want it to live past the moment and for it to also get to the people it needs to get to. Like, I feel like I've seen a few N4BL masks in here. Like, that's the kind of thing where I'm like, having work that lives past that and is not dependent on apps and systems that we don't have control over isn't how I measure that. So, yeah, but the intention economy is a huge market and it does make a lot of money. So I get why organizing centers it, and also we're not gonna have it forever. So we gotta have something else.
So I wanna touch a little bit on the last question of like, how do you respond? Because I feel like I see this a lot. You know, it's important to center Palestinians, but one of the most important things right now is to center Palestinians on the ground in Palestine, right? That's where we want to take lead from. As a Palestinian in the diaspora, that's where I learn from. I still struggle with things. There's things that, like, because I grew up here, because I've lived here for so long, I'm, like, impacted by the way that this society has like shifted things for me, and especially like when it comes to identity politics. So just because, this is not to say don't listen to Palestinians and just discard them, or don't listen to black voices and discard them, but question again, like what is their role in advancing like a capitalist agenda? For Palestinians, we center ourselves on al-thawabit. We have these principles. And so this is an opportunity to kind of like check in with those Palestinians on like, hey, how do you feel like this is reflective of the thawabit? Not to say that you need to go into like a whole conversation with them, but like, how does this help in our right to return? How does this help us move forward in our principle on Jerusalem being the capital of Palestine, from the river to the sea. We believe that Israel cannot exist and it will not exist within our lifetime. And how does that move in self-determination? So I think that's a way to kind of like have those conversations when you feel like it like challenges some of the things that you know from a like principled perspective and like a socialist framework and understanding of just, you know, checking in around like, how does this align with the Thawabit and the future of Palestinians? And to tell people we are worthy of these things. We are not asking for a lot. We should not have to say, hey, please give us a ceasefire. No. We demand the end of the occupation. We demand the end of our oppression. So let's not, you know, skirt around that for these what we might consider small wins, because in the end, they are more detrimental to us moving forward and to getting our true liberation.
Thank you. All right, y'all, we're at the sticky time. Time is a construct that capitalism really drives, but we are on a schedule. There's a little tension point there. And so I'm gonna ask something that's gonna be a little weird, but I'm gonna ask that you go with it. I want folks who have thoughts to actually present them into the space and for them to be questions that we're all left with, and that we find time to meet somebody in this room and maybe have a conversation about it. Again, BIPOC Social Tomorrow is an excellent opportunity if you are a BIPOC person to come and engage in the questions that are still ruminating. I am asking, if you go on a 2-minute thing, we don't have 2 minutes to give you, I'm so sorry. So just into the final thoughts, and so please just, we're gonna go through that line. The line is closed, do not come into it. Make the offering, and then let's find space to really be in community and be in struggle with each other over the next couple of days. Going ahead, Miles in the Nipsey Hustle shirt. You about that life, we know it. The marathon continues.
I just wanted to say, like, ask, how can we crystallize Black and Palestinian solidarity to people? Like, why, if you were in the streets for George Floyd, you have to be in the streets for Palestine and vice versa? And, like, kind of how everyone was on Biden's neck when this genocide started, rightfully so, but now it feels like a lot of people aren't on Kamala's neck. And after she picked Tim Walz to be the VP instead of, like, open Zionist, like, people... Obviously, that is a win, but it's like we still need to be on her neck because she's still committing this genocide and sending arms to Israel. So, like, how can we crystallize that for people? Because so many people have kind of, like, decentered Palestine now because they feel like we're fine. We have Kamala and that she's going to make our conditions better somehow.
Hello, my name's Samantha, I'm from Canada. I don't know anyone here, so please be my friend.
We got you, Samantha. Welcome, Samantha! Thanks.
My question for the group is, I am trying to figure out how to create invitations for non-Black and non-Indigenous people to give a shit about solidarity efforts, because we all pretend we're white, but we're not, speaking as a person who used to pretend she was white. So I'm just trying to figure out how to do that, and maybe it's at the BIPOC Social, and maybe it's in other places, but I would just love to talk to people. Okay, thanks, bye.
Good morning. My name's Ernest. Black biracial chemist from Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Came here because my Lyft driver has suggested socialism 2024. I was like,
okay.
It must be. And I said, let me go ahead and come down here, and I'm not disappointed. I used to coach high school debate and speech for 22 years at my alma mater, a local public school. We will talk. That's what I ended with my career with that. But it used to be policy and public forum and student congress. My question is, you know, I used to be able to teach, you know, emotional intellect and regulating feelings and critical thinking, you know, to my students. But how do you, because we're here because we're open-minded, we want to learn. I think that, you know, that is the biggest issue or, you know, roadblock to progress and to getting people to understand. So my question for everybody is, how do you encourage in your circle, in your community, you know, critical thinking, open-mindedness, and emotional intellect? I'm struggling with that amongst adults. Thank you.
How y'all doing? My name is Dag Maui. I'm from Philly.
All right.
So my any East Coasters around, holler at me. You know what I mean?
Keep it a bean.
Yeah, for real. Nah, for real. My question for real is just, so I'm in my fourth year at in university. I'm graduating December, inshallah. And I'm a first-generation college student. I'm a first-generation American. I'm black. And while college has given me a lot of tools and resources to education that I feel indebted to and grateful for, I see that still as like the privilege that it is. And one thing I've seen like in organizing spaces is historically and even like in, you know, contemporary work, like how much these movements are centered around academia, the intelligentsia, all that other stuff. And like, you know, my interpretation of like Marxist-Leninist rhetoric is like, you know, I keep thinking about when the revolution comes, who's gonna like aid in that? And you look at Lenin, you look at Marx, they talk about, oh, it's gonna be the intellectuals, but that's not who drives movements. You know what I mean? Like, it's the people, it's the rural folks, it's the people who don't get access to education, it's the working class that do that. So like, the question I really just wanna provide to y'all is just like, how do we, moving forward in movements, uncenter the intelligentsia and like, while still being able to utilize the privilege that they have, the things that they've been able to learn along the way, and like, what can we do to put the spotlight back on where it deserves, which is these grassroots working class, you know, organizers who have been and are doing the work. So. Yeah.
How do I follow that? That was great. Hi, assalamu alaikum. My name is Tasneem. I am from Canada also. Hi. Hi, friend. I'm also part of the Palestinian youth movement. Alhamdulillah. Everything that has been shared, even to the line of questions and comments, has really resonated. So I just want to say thank you. It's amazing to be in this space with everyone. I've tried to make my question very succinct, and it might be a little bit of a redundant one, but it's something that in this point of the movement, a lot of us are thinking about. So being here in the belly of the beast, in the West, in the Americas, we've had to come and are still trying to overcome a lot of defanging and disunity that's been present, and that was kind of the latter part of this panel discussion. But I'm really, really trying to think, and it might not be a succinct answer, but how do we come to a greater point of unity, and not just unity for the sake of unity, mm-hmm. but for the protracted struggle it will take to reach a principled, higher unity against the forces of empire, imperialism, Zionism, and fascism. Ooh. Thank you so much.
Just the light question.
Hi, I'm Justin. Excuse me, I'm Justin. I'm from Houston. Today's the last day of Black August, pretty sure. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so I'm reading Blood in My Eye by George Jackson. And one of the things he talks about is, he says, total repression and genocide are not possible, if we organize ourselves for survival first. So, you know, I'm sure everybody knows, you know, in the 60s and 70s, the Black Panther Party was doing, you know, the breakfast program. Everybody knows about that. So I feel like that would look a little bit different in 2024. I thought, you know, I was going to get some feedback from you guys, but I guess it's something for everybody to think about. But what are some things that we need in 2024? What would that look like in modern times, you know, organizing for survival for the R word? Revolution.
Hi, my name is Kamari Sherard. I just wanted to say thank you for putting this on. I'm really happy to be here. And I also want to make friends. I feel like, in order to engage with the movement for Palestine, we have to be steadfast in our fight against imperialism, racial capitalism, and colonialism. And so my question is, like, how do we strengthen solidarity as Black people and like mitigate tension with Palestinian folks who think that folks care more about Black issues than Palestinian issues, when the reality is that a lot of the principles of Black liberation movements have been hijacked and whitewashed in the dominant culture. Mm-hmm. So white people are more comfortable participating, although like their visible participation doesn't amount to any changes in our material conditions either.
When I tell you all of these questions are so rich, this could be the conference. We could just sit here and talk about this the rest of the time, and I really hope and encourage that you all do find that space. I wish we could continue on into this conversation, but please, please, look somebody in the eye. Go on ahead, turn to somebody, make eye contact with the person that you plan on finding between now and the end of your time here. So maybe dig into one of those. As we close out, I want to again remind people, when is that BIPOC social?
Tomorrow.
1 o'clock. If you are not a BIPOC individual, don't worry. That is not the only time that you can continue to commune with the Dream Defenders. We will actually be having a plenary tomorrow night. We're doing a little program called Sunday School and mashing it up with our Dear Gaza program. And so come through. It will be a beautiful experience, which we really explore just what is the spirit that takes us to get to revolution? What is the mystica that makes revolution possible? And so very excited to be in that space with you all tomorrow. But as we close, I just want to ask, one day Palestine is going to be free. And one day Black folks here on this continent, throughout the diaspora, on the motherland, and all those struggling through the legacy of colonialism and imperialism will also be free. Yeah. That is a fact that we will make possible. And so what do you hope for the day after our liberation is won?
AG put me in a weird situation because I was going to say some other things, but I'm gonna answer that question, but say this really quick because I'm an organizer and I want you to organize. So this is what I'm going to tell you right now. Joe Biden is still the president of the United States of America. And I know y'all trying to go, it's all Kamala, everybody's consumed by this election, but there's still a man in the White House who's the president of the United States of America, and he's there all the way till January something. So don't stop organizing and making sure that this president of this United States, that this administration is hearing you, because he is the man with the power that can pick up the phone and say, stop the genocide. So don't let this election distract you from the work that needs to happen. And I will say this, in this movement, unity is not uniformity in terms of tactics and strategies. And in every movement, historically, there were the Malcolms and the Dr. Martin Luther Kings. What we need to be able to do is believe in the best intentions of our comrades, that we are all trying to get to the same place and we're all going to engage in different tactics and strategies. It doesn't mean that yours is right and mine's is wrong. It could be that I'm wrong and you're right, and sometimes you're wrong and I'm right. The idea here is that we are trying to get to the same place. So let us engage in that type of grace and giving each other benefit of the doubt. And when we do not agree with comrades, call the comrades in and say, this is what I'm experiencing, this is what I'm feeling, this is what I'm seeing, and I'm not feeling it. But maybe I just don't understand what you all are doing, and having those deep conversations. Dr. Martin Luther King said this, attack the forces of evil and not the people doing evil. Okay, because we often get distracted by individuals and forget that we are here because of racism, imperialism, colonialism, and all the forces of evil that continue to oppress our people. So don't tell me Kamala Harris, don't tell me Donald Trump, don't tell me Joe Biden and every other individual that people want to raise as the quote, and they are not our enemy. Our enemy is the forces of evil that we have been fighting hundreds and hundreds of years in this world, okay? So keep the focus on the forces of evil and not the people doing evil, because you will get lost in the fray. Because after Kamala is gonna be somebody else, after Joe Biden it's somebody else, the corporations, it's gonna be somebody else. Remember what you are fighting against. And the last thing that I'll say also is the question about what are we doing right now? What is the similarities between what the Black Panther Party was doing? You already are doing it. Folks, the pandemic, mutual aid is a form of building community solidarity and saying we are all we got and taking care of one another. Mutual aid is a radical form of resistance when you are willing to say, I'm willing to help my neighbor. I am willing to stand in for my neighbor. I am willing to collect abundance from my neighbors to share with those that don't have. That, my friends, is revolutionary, and one of the most revolutionary things I've seen during the pandemic, where we were seeing so much loss and grief, but so much power in solidarity and community. All we gotta do is develop more and add more to the mutual aid efforts that continue to happen all across this country. That, my friends, is the kind of work that I wanna build. That's what my revolution looks like. One where we are interdependent on each other and not dependent on those who are perpetuating the forces of evil. And lastly, I'll say, AG, I already said this yesterday. The day after liberation, I'm gonna be on the beaches of Gaza. That's where I'm gonna be. And I just want to stand there and I want to close my eyes. I don't even want to see. I just want to hear the water on the shores of Gaza and hear the beautiful joy and laughter of the children of Gaza. You hear sometimes their laughter even amidst the bombs and the horror. You see their videos, the way they play with one. Just imagine the type of joy that we are going to hear from the children of Gaza the day after their full liberation. And that is the vision that I hold. That is what keeps me going. That's what makes me get up in the morning, because I want to reach that beach. And I want to reach those children. And I want to hold those children, because those children are our children.
Damn, Linda, you stole my answer. I will say that that's something that we have to constantly make sure is at the forefront. Hope. Because despair is treason. They want us to be despaired. So when we think of the future, we can't only think of the atrocities that are happening today. We have to imagine liberation. And for me, it is return. Mm-hmm. I'm going back to Palestine.
There you are.
I will be sitting on the beaches of Gaza, listening to oud playing in the background and eating some jibna nabilsiyye with a little bit of watermelon, makes a delicious sandwich. I will be walking the streets of Ramallah and having some ice cream. I will be sitting at cafes and drinking tea and struggling with people and knowing that there's still work that will need to be done, because a society is never perfect and we will continue. But with the peace that we have already defeated the biggest monster.
Ooh, such a great question. I think the day after liberation, I'm probably taking my butt back to North Carolina. But more specifically, I think those points about interdependence feel really important. And more specifically, I'll say, as a Black queer person, a survivor, I can't imagine liberation that doesn't have a survivor ethic, that doesn't liberate Black trans folks, that doesn't liberate Black queer people, and that doesn't return the land to our people as well. So that's what I'm thinking of. And also just the importance of collective works. I'm like, the liberation I want is really just to like be in my community and doing shit together, and not having the weight of all the isms and stuff like impacting our ability to survive and to relate and to connect with each other. I don't want to leave any parts of myself behind on the day of our liberation. So that includes queer folks, trans folks, survivors. So, yeah.
Yeah, I'll keep it short and sweet. I'm going to live off of the land. If y'all knew me, that's actually wild to say, but I'm doing it. I'm doing it. Somebody got to filter this water. I want to thank you all so much for being a part of this conversation. I want to thank each and every part of this panel. Linda, Lemma, Clarissa, thank you all for offering your insights. Okay. Yes.
Happy birthday to you.
All right, we'll work on that. Some of y'all, we'll introduce the Stevie one. It happens. Thank y'all so much. And give yourselves a round of applause as we leave.
Thanks for listening. If you liked this episode, subscribe to our podcast and to the Haymarket Books YouTube channel, where events like this one are hosted live.
And don't forget to check out haymarketbooks.org.